I'm going to be talking in English. My name is Robert Norse. Stay tuned for 2 hours of chit-chat on local stuff, particularly around civil rights issues. And this is the May 29th, 2010 show. Stay tuned.
Take my hand and I'll show you a dance that's really new. Way back home at the Hippodrome, it's the one the sheiks all do. No one can resist the rhythm. It's like driving racing cars. He will love you when you're with him, stepping through the stars. A gray-haired angels let their head down. Beelzebub forgets to frown. Everyone forgets their troubles when they step off from the ground. You can reach him if you teach him, stepping through the stars. Just close your eyes and stand on tiptoe. Think of something très bizarre. Change these things from arms to wings and go stepping through the stars. Go stepping through the stars. Go stepping through the stars. He will love you when you're with him, stepping through the stars.
Living up here in the penthouse, life can really be refined. Not a junkie or a gin house, but in the penthouse of your mind. Foolish, finite, fickle, fiddlers, stellar dwellers, turn on and shine. You can be a fortune teller in the penthouse of your mind.
Take the express, forget the local, as any local yokel knows. Elevator going upward,
you only have to look for the tip of your nose. So can't you tell like I just balconies and promenades, top of the mind, please look at the view. Can you believe it's you living in a dislike? That's the life for you and me. Just push the button. That's more people the fifth house of your mind.
And that was a cut from John Phillips' Jack of Diamonds. I've been playing a lot of his stuff called Steppin' to the Stars, Penthouse of Your Mind. Phillips, of course, was with the Mamas and the Papas. In fact, I'm the chief writer for that group. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.1 FM. We also stream at freakradio.org. And we have a phone here, which you can reach at 427-3772, 427-FRSC. 831-427-3772 for those outside the Santa Cruz area. And your calls are welcome. I'm particularly interested in local issues around civil rights and the deprivation thereof, which is, of course, what a lot of poor people face every day. Some of them not even knowing it, some of them not even realizing it, and mostly powerless to do anything about it, even those of us who aren't as poor as the rest of us, until we all get together and decide to do something about it. Sort of like ending the war in Afghanistan. Electing an African-American is not ending the war in Afghanistan. And I guess we should have known from Condoleezza Rice that would be no key to successful peace. Anyway, it requires all of us to change these things, or at least many of us, or some of us at least. So if you want to contribute your thoughts, your energies, your efforts, that's great. That's what I'd like to see happen. And we're going to be talking a lot about local events. Some of them, you know, may seem trivial to you or not particularly relevant, like the attempt to destroy the downtown Wednesday drum circle, which began a week ago, actually began long ago, but most recent effort or most recent aggression was the farmers market's takeover of the parking lot number 4 space under the trees, which the drum circle traditionally played at. And this was done without any kind of discussion with the drummers, without any kind of interaction. It just suddenly, commercial ventures suddenly showed up selling stuff, where previously people had had a free space, a public space where they could be. Instead, it now became a leased commercial space from which the drum circle is driven away. And the answer question might be, well, why doesn't the drum circle just, come at it, go to another place or take another time? And the answer has to do also with the whole structure of laws that have been instituted in Santa Cruz by the vice mayor, Ryan Coonerty, the mayor, Mike Rodkin, and the city council under the shadow leadership of Dick Wilson, the city manager, who may be retiring this summer, but his influence marches on. And, of course, groups like the Santa Cruz Police Department, the entrenched staff of the city, the Downtown Association, the Chamber of Commerce, conservative residence groups, Santa Cruz Neighbors, and so forth, who want to see the whole cultural scene in Santa Cruz gentrified. And to that aim, they have passed laws that essentially give the police exorbitant powers to intrude on the private lives of people, particularly poor people who are in the public spaces, sitting down, doing nothing offensive, doing nothing criminal, simply trying to rest or to socialize. It becomes illegal in 95% of the space on Pacific Avenue to sit down within 14 feet of a building and within 14 feet of all kinds of other objects, suddenly newly cooked up objects d'art, art objects, sculptures, which are nice to have on Pacific Avenue, provided they aren't simply no homeless zones that are created, which in fact is what they are. They don't have got a lot to do with art. They have a lot to do with making sure that human beings don't use the space that they are entitled to by creating so-called time, place, and manner regulations that severely restrict that kind of behavior. And this is a fight I've been fighting for decades, and I encourage you to pick up some cudgels on it, too. The Drum Circle is a group of people who have been traditionally gathering every Wednesday at parking lot number 4 of the Farmer's Market, and drumming. And I'm not a big drummer. I don't drum. I don't appreciate listening to drumming particularly. It doesn't really get on my nerves, but it's not my thing particularly. What is my thing is the right of people to use public spaces, in spite of the fact that Ryan Coonerty wants to run everybody off of 10 square blocks, has run everybody off of 10 square blocks of public space, the parking lots and parking garages, which our taxes pay for, based on the paranoid fantasy that it's dangerous for people to associate in these spaces, and that somehow a public safety requirement that you either walk directly through or walk to get a vehicle and retrieve it, walk to get a bicycle and retrieve it, a car or a bicycle. So we're at the moment under the aegis of these laws, and what's happening with the Drum Circle is the Farmer's Market, without any discussion, as I said, suddenly occupied the space of that the Drum Circle had been using. And the Drum Circle moved a block away to the area in front of Jack's, or I should say across the street from Jack's in the parking lot. Some call it the Pearl Alley parking lot. I call it the Badass Coffee parking lot, even though Badass is gone. The big sign is still there. And that's where the Drum Circle operated last week, I should say yesterday, as well as last week, for 2 weeks running. However, they received some severe warnings from Sergeant Harms and backup police that they would be ticketed next week. And I've written a story about that if you want to read about it more in more detail. I wasn't present when the warnings were given. I was present earlier in the day when people showed up into this relatively small space that people have been kind of forced into in terms of the seizure of the larger space at the Farmer's Market. Previously, the open parking lot number 4, which was turned into a pay parking lot, which was then turned also into a commercial zone. And apparently there's a real threat that people are going to be getting citations for anywhere from $100 to $300. I'm not clear what the fine is going to be. They're threatening to give citations under our old friend the Unreasonably Disturbing Noises Law, which is 9.36.020, and I've talked about this law ad infinitum on and on, because I'm charged with it for singing downtown the homeless version in front of the bookshop Santa Cruz. Activist Becky Johnson has been convicted of criminal singing on the sidewalk. And trials were scheduled for, another trial was scheduled for Robert Blind Bear Facer on Tuesday. That trial, by the way, and this is a report from the court, has been postponed. The trial has now been moved to July 20th and combined with my case. So both Robert Facer and me, Robert Norris, will go to trial together on that date, assuming that the authorities don't wise up and do something better with the city money than attempt to prosecute political singers. I don't think it's such a hot idea. And Robert Facer isn't a political singer. He's just a homeless man who supports the rights of people to, well, he supports the issues that we're concerned about because he's homeless, particularly the sleeping ban, which he's been charged with violating, sleeping after 11 o'clock at night in Santa Cruz on the beach in a city that has no zero walk-in emergency shelter for anyone tonight. They have some programs, but you have to get onto waiting lists, and they only serve a fraction of the homeless community, and the rest of the people face $97 tickets. Or is it 98? I can never remember which. In any case, this law is now being put forward to threaten the drummers, and it's not being put forward by the police who say, oh, we don't find it unreasonably disturbing. Jax does, or I don't even know it's Jax. I don't think it's Jax. It's some other business person across the street. My apologies to Connie of Jax. I don't know the names of the individuals who are concerned about the drumming, which apparently is the complaints were made after the businesses had closed. And there's a lot of hubbub downtown around that time. In fact, I'd say, well, Pacific Avenue is usually the busiest street in town. If you want to look at the entire traffic flow throughout the day, well, Laurel Street's pretty busy, too. But Cedar Street, the street on which the drummers are now on next to, they're next to the sidewalk there in one of the, not grassy areas, but dirted areas around a tree, it's a pretty busy street, too. And there's a lot of hubbubs. And the drumming, the idea of the drumming itself is unreasonably disturbing is, I think, not credible. Now, of course, the city council can always move in and do what Mike Rotkin tried to do in 1996, which is pass an anti-drumming law, which he didn't do because the city council split on it and the drummers agreed to be more sensitive. Mediation efforts were involved. This, of course, was when there was a drum circle every week that was accepted as a cultural tradition in Santa Cruz. And although it's ironic, the farmers market itself was attacked by the downtown association and moved because, though it was initially regarded as a kind of a benefit in bringing people back after the earthquake, people began to be patronizing the farmers market and buying groceries and other necessaries there and not buying the knickknacks of the little shops on the Pacific Avenue. This really, apparently, according to writer Celine Marie Pascal, provoked resentment among the downtown association folks. So they moved the farmers market, which was originally in the on kind of adjacent to Pacific Avenue on Wednesday, in the big parking lot that was Ford's department store and then became Taqueria Vallarta after that was built, over to its current location, off of Pacific Avenue. And now, of course, the farmers market is itself kind of got this expansionist philosophy. And, you know, I really don't know. I'd like to get some more insight into the internal mechanics of how this happened, and maybe we will. But I think it's also important for people to, while they still can, stand up for the public spaces that we have had, been able to maintain for the last couple of years, and now are really on the edge of losing. And it's not about drumming, really. It's about the right to occupy and use public spaces that all of us have a right to, not just commercial businesses, not just people that Ryan Coonerty wants to make money off of with automobiles, but the entire community, spaces that have traditionally been community spaces. And that apparently is going to be under threat next Wednesday. I encourage people to show up there. It's actually under threat all the time, but it's particularly important on Wednesdays, and this is actually what I was getting to before when I said, when I was asking the question, why doesn't the drum circle just move to another spot, you know, San Lorenzo Park, Town Clock, Lighthouse Field, Canada. You know, why don't they just move somewhere and then that'll be, you know, a solution to the problem? Well, it was pointed out by one writer on Indie Bay, and this is being discussed on Santa Cruz Indie Media, in case you want to read some of the discussion. You know, they said the same thing to Native Americans. All you got to do is move. But they kept moving them. And that's the question of how far this is going to go. And also, this is a downtown activity. It's now being, people are saying you can't really be downtown. It's like what they're trying to do with people on Pacific Avenue. They're trying to move them off of and away from all the businesses on Pacific Avenue. And at the same time, of course, they're ironically, you know, making it illegal to sleep. It's illegal to sleep in the Poganip. John Wallace is running people out of the parks. He's the chief ranger. And you have a situation where people are just generally being told to disappear. And this is part of the paranoid fantasy that it's poor people visible that is causing the economic downturn, along with the drug war fantasy and the gang fantasy that these are all connected with the homeless in some way, or that, you know, that if you have people selling small quantities of marijuana are a major threat on Pacific Avenue or elsewhere, which is preposterous. I mean, this whole thing is... I thought we were adults in this community. Actually, I didn't think we were adults. I knew that the authorities are operating on a very kind of paranoid level, which serves people in power very well when they operate on that level. So the, and I'm straying a bit here, the point of why don't they move is that really the drum circle can only effectively exist, I think, if it's near a large congregation of people who can keep an eye on what's going on, so that if the police intervene, as they did in September of 2008, an attempt to destroy the drum circle. In this case, they were putting up little mesh fences around the places where people usually play and harassing people, serving free food. They falsely arrested one guy for Jack Russ for, they claimed, clipping the fence, meaning he was unfastening or snipping the tie that held this green mesh fence together, which was then done every week for the next 5-6 months to make sure, because drummers were not going to tolerate, and the community generally was not tolerating this idea of the police suddenly deciding that a certain cultural event was a taboo in the society and was going to be removed by diktat. In any case, the attempt of the police to storm the area with storm troops and violent arrest of both Jack Russ and Wes Modes by Sergeant Harms and his goon squads. And that's what they were acting like. I'm sorry, Sergeant Harms. Much as I enjoy conversations with you, that kind of behavior on the part of the police is way out of line, in my view. And then Harms and others, according to Wes Modes, who was the guy arrested, for a whole year held off on meaningful discovery so that the court case dragged and dragged. Modes finally agreed to a deal, and this is also another story on Indie Bay, and I'll be talking about it too. And now he faces a betrayal on that deal with the district attorney. He's being accused of organizing the DIY parade on New Year's Eve. Ironically, he didn't do anything to do with it, at least according to his account, and I believe him. A lot of us, myself included, had a lot to do with that in the sense that we participated. Hundreds and hundreds of people participated in that parade. They didn't get cited. They didn't get arrested. He got cited, and the citation isn't just simply a simple infraction. It could send him back to jail for felony activity, and there's actually a benefit coming up for him at 7 o'clock on Sunday night at the Resource Center for Inaction. I mean, the Resource Center for Nonviolence. In this case, they're not being inactive. Congratulations over there, RCNV. Usually they're real hot on distant issues, you know, Israel, Palestine, but don't give a shit about local police problems. In this case, I say I'm glad to see it, that they are. I hope this represents a new trend. And it has to be said, the Resource Center also lends out its facilities to community groups like Free Radio Santa Cruz to meet. We meet there every other week. Just don't try to come to our meetings. We'll make sure that you don't get in. That's a part of the super secret approach here at Free Radio Santa Cruz. Don't tell anybody about that. So Drum Circle is under attack. It'll be happening next Wednesday. If it, maybe the police won't be attacking, but they have threatened to do so. And it's perhaps we can have some people calling in who were at the Drum Circle who might want to talk about that issue. Phone lines are open, 427-3772. Without the presence of the farmers market around and a lot of people there, I'm afraid the police will be able to intimidate the Drum Circle into just disappearing entirely, except into private spaces or very distant spaces where they won't be accessible as a point of community gathering and just general kind of social interaction there, which is what happens. I mean, not only do people drum, but they play instruments, they eat, they play chess, they talk, they dance, they enjoy the sunshine. It's a kind of a downtown public space, and there's no record of any significant criminal problem there. Yeah, they smoke some marijuana, you know. Okay, well, let's all run and hide our heads in the sand and start screaming. And, you know, it's a pretty sad commentary that becomes a problem for Santa Cruz. Smoking marijuana is not a problem. I don't think smoking generally is a problem except for the people who smoke, although it can be annoying to other people. And indoors, you know, there can be some health considerations. However, we're talking about a diverse community with a whole bunch of different kinds of folks. And we're talking about one segment of the community, a very frankly right-wing kind of segment, crushing street culture here, crushing the opportunity of poor people to get together in a free space. And that's something I think we should all resist. Wednesday at 2:30 or earlier, come on down to Cedar and Lincoln, which is where the Drum Circle has temporarily decamped to, or is where they've been for the last 2 weeks. And help out. Bring your video camera. Bring your friends. Bring an audio recorder if you've got one. Bring your cell phones to take photos. And try to bring some cojones as well, you know, because if the police can scare you away, they tend to do that. That's the problem. And I understand a lot of people are not interested in civil disobedience in these circumstances. I'm not really either. I don't like taking citations. But sometimes it's necessary in order to resist effectively. So you might consider that as a possibility. Call-in number here again is 427-3772. If you'd like to call in, I'm talking about the police pressure on the Wednesday Drum Circle, which used to be next to the Farmer's Market, now is across the street from the Farmer's Market in the Pearl Alley parking lot, and potential mass ticketing coming up next Wednesday if the police proceed to do what they've threatened to do under Sergeant Harms. Let's have a little musical break after we take this phone call. Hi, you're on the air with Robert.
Hi, Robert. It's Craig, Canada.
Hey, Craig, what's a good word?
Oh, I got a notice. I'm just getting it now.
A notice?
On the 17th. Court ordered demand for payment. Let me turn you off here.
Good enough.
There we go. Now we
always remember to tell the rest of the audience.
And I thought you'd be interested. Might be interested in it. It's for that sleeping ticket they found me guilty of.
Huh.
You recall that. You there?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yeah. Can you hear me? This sounds kind of faint.
No, I can hear you. You're coming through loud and strong. You of course were acquitted of one sleeping ticket about two in the summer of 2007, I think it was.
I think it was four. I actually had pulled up the article.
Oh, yeah? Okay. Remind me then.
Our blog entry that I wrote about that, I was just referring to it. But,
uh-huh.
Yeah, I got up. This is, and then they found me guilty of another one, and I never paid it. I think it was originally $96. The amount due on this is $396.
Wow.
And it's dated the 19th of April, and it says, if I don't pay it within 10 days of the date, and I got it 2 days ago, that they will garnish your wages or other sources of income, attach your bank account, seize and sell your real or personal property, file a lien to attach all real property you own or may acquire in California, attach your California state income tax refund by our lottery winnings.
There goes your big win there, Craig. I know. What are you going to do with that million that you picked up last time?
Let me see if I can turn my phone up because I can't hear you.
Interesting. Well, so the sleeping ticket that was, actually...
Okay, I can hear you now.
Good, good. The sleeping ticket that was... The first sleeping ticket or the first bunch of sleeping tickets you were acquitted of in the court of Deneen Guy, who used to be Department 1's judge. Now it's taken over by Ariadne Simons. Because you are a medical marijuana user and... it was shown that, you can't get any kind of emergency accommodation with medical. You can't get any kind of accommodation, actually, in terms of government services like shelter in our county, if I'm not mistaken, Craig.
Well, yeah, after I ran for city council and John Lane and Don Lane and Catherine Byers made a big show of being my good buddy, I learned that they were on the board of homeless services at that time and voted to deny housing to medical marijuana patients, with the result that I was homeless for 3 years.
Right, but then when you were outside and sleeping outside, you were given a citation for the sleeping ban, which makes it illegal for homeless, essentially for people to be homeless.
Had a bunch of them. I think there were six in all. I was reviewing my blog entry, as I said, and I think you actually or somebody wrote that the officer didn't show up on one ticket, so that was dismissed, but they found me guilty of the second because I couldn't put on the whole case again. The reason that I was found guilty primarily the first time was because Linda LeMasters testified as an expert witness, being on the board of what was the name of that organization?
That's the reason. That's the reason you were Craig. That's the reason you were found not guilty the first time, right? Yeah. I think you said guilty, but yeah, you were found not guilty by reason of necessity. You had to sleep outside because part of your medical treatment requires medical marijuana. And then the same judge, with essentially the same set of facts, turned it around 2 months later in another citation for the same offense. It was very strange. And for those who want to read about that case, they can go to the Street Spirit. Just Google for Craig Canada Street Spirit, and you'll find the long article on it. But go ahead. You say you've gotten this ticket now for $396. Sounds like a $96 ticket or a $97 ticket, to which they've added $299 as a an encouragement for you to go in and empty your pockets.
Well, yeah, Robert, I actually did have enough credit to be able to space on my credit card that I can charge it, and I paid it today.
You did pay it.
I think most people in my situation would not be able to pay it and pay the rent, and it would be the last straw for them. I actually received, I haven't had to pay for medicine for the last several months, this place called Grace Farm in Trinity County blessed me with a marijuana miracle. So I haven't had to buy medicine, and so I was able to otherwise I wouldn't have been able to pay it off, and I'd be calling you up screaming for help.
Well, I'm glad at least you're informing us, but let me ask you about the marijuana issue. Two questions. I'll begin with, you were at last Thursday's Americans for Safe Action meeting, or were you? I don't know.
Americans for Safe Access, yes, I was. There was not one person from Greenway or from Santa Cruz Collective or from WAM there. Yeah, Roger Mitch was trying to organize a local chapter of ACE, and he needs 10 people, 10 card-carrying ASA members to form a local chapter. I think it's 35 years to be a member for a year of ASA. And it seems like he's got a trial date coming up, and I think he said May the 17th, but I'm not sure about that. And he was really interested in organizing court support. And I know that's the most important thing in the world when you're in court, is if you have friends in the audience and the judge can see the testimony reflected in their faces and accusations reflected in their faces, if you know what I mean. That's my opinion. That's the most important thing you can do for somebody, is go to and sit in court for them and let the judge and the jury see your reaction to what happens.
Well, I hope that the people do. His trial is in San Jose, right?
Yeah, I think it's his third or fourth one. This is the third or fourth time he's been charged. And quite frankly, I've gotten fairly confused. Thank you so much.
Yeah, I've tried to get him to call in. We had one conversation, but he hasn't really updated me recently. And I'm glad you were present at this meeting. How did it go? I mean, was there much? I guess you didn't. Did you have the 10 members, or were there not enough people?
No, there weren't. I don't know if or when there's going to be another one. He said that Luden Nelson charges them $32, I think, for 2 hours for a room, and they got enough contributions to more than cover that. Not enough to pay for the next room, and as far as I know, there were 10 people there, and I'm not an ASIN member, and I can't afford to be one. And
how much does it cost?
What was it?
How much does it cost to be an Americans for Safe Access member?
It's $35 a year. That probably doesn't seem like much, but I can't afford it.
Well, that's because you're paying this very important $398 fines or whatever, $396 sleeping tickets.
Well, you know what is so annoying is, Robert, I charged motel rooms. I have $9,000 in debt on my credit card. And I was just beginning to pay that off and then I get this thing from the city. $400 for, you know, and basically they did not, I won't, very angry about the whole thing.
I think you should
it's
be.
It's like they knock you down. And the fact is that most people, this would make them homeless.
Yeah. Well, that's the irony of it. You know, the actual ticket itself is for sleeping outside, which is what homeless people have to do. What about the other issue that I think you have, you're really very knowledgeable on, Tax and Regulate Initiative that has made the ballot, and then, of course, the recent death of Jack Harar and I presume the failure of his initiative to make the ballot. You've written a bit about that on your on the website examiner.com?
Yeah, I have, and I was hoping to write more. I was actually in the middle of trying to write some articles about this when I got this damn notice from the city, demand for payment, which, you know, took 2 days of my time.
Don't want to distract you.
Well, I spent a lot of time trying to find out what my options were.
Right, right.
And I didn't really get any response from anybody. A bail bondsman told me they'd probably issue a bench warrant.
Well,
I asked a bunch of people, and I asked the court clerk, which was a mistake. I'm sure that she, you know, made sure that I didn't pay if something would happen.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I think your case is really an important one, not just for you. And often I feel that, you know, that it's really important to recognize that an individual's case is not just that person, but, you know, anybody who gets an infraction citation and then disregards it can be in your shoes. I mean, I know that, for example, Micah Posner got a citation months later for doing a bike parade on King Street, supposedly without a permit. He's ignored that citation, I understand. And, you know, he may end up with this huge amount of money being charged to him, which, you know, then apparently, at least they threaten, has all these consequences. And it's really important for us to know how much of this is bullshit and how much of this is really true. And I appreciate your bringing the issue up, not that I have any, you know, immediate answers for you. But let me ask again about the subject in which you do have answers, because you have studied it, you've written about it, you've researched it. Tell us a bit about the strengths and the weaknesses of the Tax and Regulate Initiative insofar as, you know, the positives and the negatives.
Well, you know, the first thing that comes to mind is that Bruce Kane, who has the website New Age Citizen, www.newagecitizen.com, but anyway, he just put out an article, and that should be on his front page if you go to his website. And he has a chart where he lists a number of things. In fact, I think I'll put the phone down and pull that up. My biggest concern, well, first of all, Dennis Perone has video. And if you go to my blog, www.palmspringsbum.org/blog, now I'm not on Blogspot anymore, but I think it's my second or third story on my blog. I've got this video of Dennis Perone, and he was endorsing one of the initiatives that didn't make it, the California Cannabis Hemp and Health Initiative or something. I don't remember the exact title of it. But anyway, he was endorsing one that did not get on the ballot, not the Jack Hare Initiative. And he basically said he was declaring war on tax and regulate. And then there's a video of Dennis Perone that you can find on my blog. And Bruce Kane, and there's myself, that are opposed to it. In a nutshell, it seems to me that what tax and regulate is going to do is, well, first of all, if you look at the vote map of 1996 for Proposition 215, you'll see that the counties that voted for 215 and against, those are basically the coastal counties. And my point is that if tax and regulate should pass in California, you're going to have probably the Emerald Triangle counties and San Francisco and Alameda that are going to legalize commercial cultivation and sales. I doubt any other California is going to do it. Basically, what tax and regulate does is it will enable every city and county in the state to prohibit commercial cultivation and sales. There's a question in my mind, and I think one of the first legal challenges that's going to be made is whether tax and regulate and the limits in tax and regulate, including the personal possession limit of 1 ounce and the personal cultivation limit of 25 square feet, whether these limits are going to apply to medical marijuana patients, because if you look at it in items 7 and 8, now I'm saying this all from memory, but I think this is under purposes, where it exempts medical marijuana patients, specifically Health and Safety Code 11362.5 and 11362.73 through 11362.7 through 11362.83. It exempts those codes, which are the medical marijuana laws, but it only does it for cities and not for counties. And it's a horrible law, in my opinion.
Let me ask you a couple more things. So does it change the – I understand it makes it a more serious crime to give away marijuana to someone who's 19 or 20 or to sell it to someone who's 19 or 20.
It adds one felony, I believe, and I'd have to look it up. But if you read the initiative, there's, I think – three different levels of crimes concerning minors. There's an A and a B, and it adds number C, which I think is for someone over 21 to give it to someone that's under 21, over 18, either that or it's for anyone to give it to furnish to someone from 18 to 21. I think that's the one it adds. It adds one felony for furnishing to a minor.
Now, does this include medical marijuana, or is it exempt medical marijuana?
Well, you know, that's a good question, because, and I've been meaning to sit down. The thing is a jigsaw puzzle, and you've got terms like without limitation sprinkled all through it, and you've got terms like without respect to any other law sprinkled all through it. And then you've got the three jurisdictions, city, county, local jurisdiction. Those are three terms defined within the document.
Sorry, city, county, and what?
Yeah, Ron, what were you going to say?
City, county, and what?
Local.
And local.
Government.
Local, yeah, okay.
Local government is city or county.
So this means, as you read it at the moment, although I guess you're going to be doing more research and writing on it at the, examiner.com, or is it the palmsprings.com/blog?
I'll be writing articles about this on examiner.com. I'm the Santa Cruz Drug Policy Examiner.
Now, has the local ACLU drug policy, I should say the national ACLU Drug Policy Project, which has its headquarters here locally on the second or third floor above Taqueria Vallarta at Cathcart and Pacific, said anything about this initiative or that you know of?
You know, I'm not aware of that. You know, I was just actually looking them up because I understand that Mike Brockin was on the board, and I was trying to find a listing of the board of directors, and I couldn't find the San Francisco office anywhere. It looks like it may have moved. Are you sure it's still there?
Well, the drug policy, I'm not sure. I've been there for about a year or two, but I was told by Ben Rice a month ago, who's, you know, a big drug lawyer in town, that it's still around. And I know that I did contact the ACLU in San Francisco about the case of two ACLU people who were ticketed outside Trader Joe's for trespass, for giving out trying to give out ACLU information, you know, right next to Trader Joe's in the parking lot of that.
Oh, you mean where the Salvation Army stands all the time asking for donations?
Yeah, that's what I mean, yeah. And they were given citations with the cooperation of the Santa Cruz Police Department. And I tried to get a hold of San Francisco to find out when their trial was, and nobody knew about that. Tried to find the local ACLU on the website, and apparently the best I could do is I was finally able to reach Don Zimmerman, who's the ACLU legal guy, or was. He's been inactive now for a number of months because of other projects he's been involved in, he tells me. But he says that often the ACLU is pretty moribund at the moment locally, and that the website, there's no way to contact them through the website directly. At least there's no phone number. I guess there's still fundraising in the area. But, you know, I guess I get fuzzy and tend to go off into other directions when I think of the ACLU locally, because it pisses me off that they aren't concerned about the drug war locally and that they are, you know, fundraising themselves to death and putting out all these, you know, bright promises for students and others who are civil libertarian activists, except around such things as the sleeping ban locally and laws that impact homeless people. But again, I would like to get you, once you've done your writing and your thinking on this issue and really carefully researched Tax and Regulate, to come back and give us some more thoughts, because many of the local activists, Kim,
well, I can give you some thoughts right now, Robert. Now consider this. Richard Lee pays $30,000 a year for his license.
Explain who Richard Lee is.
Richard Lee is the proponent of Tax and Regulate. He has this plantation, as it's been called in the press, in Oakland. He's one of the four licensed dispensaries in Oakland. There's four. They have a cap of four dispensaries, and each of them pay $40,000. Now, I could go on forever because I'm very angry about this, but let's see. It was Maine that recently passed legislation, and I'm trying to remember. The license for dispensary in California is $400. Okay, I think it was Maine recently passed legislation. They're going to allow eight dispensaries in the state. They have eight health districts, one for each health district. They're going to charge patients 5% tax on their medicine, and on top of this, they're going to charge dispensaries $15,000 apiece. So basically, they plan to get $100,000 from dispensary licenses and $100,000 from patients. They're going to be this is based on 500 patients. The patients are supposed to be using 60 ounces a year, which works out to 5 ounces a month. And 5 ounces a month is about right for a seriously ill patient. However, all these laws only allow patients to have 2.5 ounces a month. Now, this is not directly related to Tax and Regulate per se, but this is what's going on all over the country. There was another state that just passed taxes on dispensaries. I think Colorado in Denver, Denver just charged each dispensary $5,000. That's 235 dispensaries. That's $1 million. They just got off their dispensaries. And, this is medical they're doing. And in Maine, the license for pharmacy is $200. And in Colorado, the license for pharmacy is $450. This is some of the research I've been doing along these lines. And by the way, the production cost of marijuana is about $275 to $5. It's not much. We're talking about an ounce here, $2.75 an ounce, maybe.
$2.75 or $275.
Excuse me?
How much per ounce to produce it?
You're breaking up, Robert. Battery may be going. I don't again.
Can you hear how much to produce an ounce of marijuana? How much would you estimate it costs to produce an ounce of marijuana? Can you hear me?
Far less than $20 an ounce. Actually, if I put the phone down and type in some things, I just did an article on that and I could tell you my figures. Because I'm hesitant to quote it without looking it up.
No, that's less than $20.
I can tell you that
Craig,
the University
Craig,
of
Craig,
Mississippi
Craig.
Growth. You still there?
Yeah, Craig, less than $20 an ounce is a good figure. That's all I need from you. I mean, that's dirt cheap. And I guess what Dennis Perone was saying when he opposed the tax regulated measure, because I saw some of the video, or one of the videos, I think, that he did about this, maybe the one you're talking about, and I'm going to try to play the audio of that on my show at some point. is that what is essentially being done here from his perspective is that they're making home growing illegal in a fundamental kind of way. That it's like
that's correct. And also, it's basically you're going to have a few people who are going to get very rich and have a monopoly.
Right. And that would be Richard Lee would be one of those people, right?
Right. And in 2 years from now, I suspect that these people are going to have all the money they need to quash anything that threatens to break up their monopoly. And so you're going to have, if you look at like dry straight states, like if you look on the web and look up Alabama, which has wet and dry counties, that's what California is going to look like. The wet and dry laws went into effect in Alabama 70 years ago. And I swear to God, if you've ever lived in a wet and dry state, there's still half the state of Alabama's dry.
Meaning you cannot buy or brew beer or wine?
That's right.
Wow. And, you know, the other thing I noticed in the paper, I'm sure you saw the headline, well, I imagine you may have seen the headline in the Sentinel about the restrictions on marijuana dispensaries being the strictest in the state. I'm not sure if those guidelines...
Of course.
I didn't see the city council meeting on Tuesday. I've got to review it. I've seen it. I've got a tape I can look at and maybe will if I have enough, fortify myself with enough painkillers. But they were intending, according to the Sentinel, to establish very elaborate review procedures for the two dispensaries. Not that I have a lot of sympathy for the two dispensaries that are, I think, you know, gutless wonders in pushing for their own duopoly in Santa Cruz County, Greenway, and Ken Sampson's Lime Kiln Club. But this growing tendency essentially is prohibitionism masquerading as regulation. What do you think?
Well, absolutely. And see, that's exactly what tax and regulators do. We have lawsuits coming up, and I can't tell you where not right now, for instance, challenging the bans on dispensaries, the cities that have outright bans on them.
Mm-hmm.
We have lawsuits for medical marijuana coming up on that. Now, tax and regulate, all of this, you know, all these different rules from city to city and county to county all over the state, tax and regulate is going to enshrine that system into statutory law. It's going to make it legal for cities to ban it. Each city is going to be required, and county is going to be required to come up with its own regulation. And I cannot for the life of me understand why anybody with any sense would ever support anything which does, as this does, authorize the government to tax, regulate, and without limitation. I just cannot understand why anybody would authorize the government to do anything without limitation.
Craig, how does this compare with Ammiano's bill in the state legislature?
Well, you know, I can't tell you precisely. Ammiano has limits. I've most recently looked at Jack Harris' initiative, which didn't make it. And that one had a limit on the combined excise tax per ounce of $10.
Well, what I'm wondering is, is there something in Tom Ammiano's bill that would allow cities and counties to ban sales and distribution or to regulate it out of existence?
The answer is I don't know.
Okay.
It's been so long since I've read it.
But
at this point, it could be in a different permutation.
Sure. If you come up with more information about this, I'm hoping we can. You know, we're obviously going to be following the subject for the next few months. When you learn more, please let us know, or let me know, and I'll let everybody. Well, we can let everybody know, because I know a lot of advocates around here. I know favor this initiative as a good first step, and
haven't read it.
Yeah, I'm becoming increasingly skeptical. I mean, I haven't read it either. I've read the critics of it. I've read the supporters of it. I haven't had
you shouldn't do that, Robert. You should just read the initiative.
Just read the initiative. Yeah. Well, I got to get the patience and the gumption to do that. But at least
that's what they're counting on, is that nobody's going to read it.
Right. Well, that's what they did with the Patriot Act, I guess. Huh?
It was a lot longer. The one thing that I'm certain about with Ammiano's initiative is that it did exempt meth patients from the tax. And I have the impression that a medical patient, for instance, could go into a commercial sales establishment and purchase and not be charged the tax that they would charge everyone else, and that was how it would work.
Okay. Well, we're talking with Craig Canada, and Craig, I'm going to roll it up, but let me give you the last word on this. And also, if you're doing any organizing, or if you want people to, give you any input, because I know you're writing about this stuff locally, maybe you'd appreciate some local input. Please let people know about it now.
Well, I'm not organizing anything at the moment. I feel like I'm just now getting on my feet, quite frankly, and getting back to myself after being homeless for 3 years with a psychiatric condition. And I really don't have any much else to say. I did just essentially call about the notice. I thought you'd like to know about that. I'm just very lucky that I was able to pay it. As I said, if someone out of the blue hadn't donated some medicine for me, I wouldn't have the credit to do it. And I would really be in a bind right now.
And for those who just tuned in, Craig is talking about a bill he got for $396?
Yeah, it was the day before 420 they sent it to me. It's dated 419, and I received it on the 27th, I think.
This is a bill for a sleeping ban citation or a set of... It was one citation, wasn't it, we're talking about?
Yeah, one citation, which I didn't pay.
Now, did you pay all the other ones, or are they coming in the mail?
No, they were dismissed.
Okay, so you got one. But there are a lot of people who have sleeping bans tickets aplenty who are going to be facing a $396, that's a $96 or $97 or $98 ticket, plus essentially a $300 garnishment added to it, plus all this stuff, at least they say, garnishing your wages, attaching your bank account, seizing and selling real property, filing a lien on any property you have, attaching a state income tax refund, or lottery winning, you know, and there goes, you know, that million, as I said, that you picked up, Craig. I'm sorry to hear that. So.
Yeah, and it also says on here that... a partial payment will not stop collection action or the addition of interest. So, I just thought you'd like to know about that.
That's some nasty shit, Craig. I appreciate your letting me know about that.
Okay.
And for those who are interested, it's Craig, it's Palm Springs Bum?
Yeah, my blog's at... palmspringsbum.org/blog, there should be like a way to contact me on there for that.
Okay.
Okay.
Thanks for calling in, man.
Uh-huh.
All righty.
Bye.
And that was Craig Canada. You're tuned to Free Radio, 101.1 FM, www.freakradio.org. Call-in lines are open, 427-3772. 427-3772, in case you want to talk about this issue. I'm not as prepared as I want to be. I've done, a cursory look at the critics of this initiative, as well as some looking at those who supported it, as I said before. But we need to really, I suppose it has to be gone over line by line, which is something I really don't want to do, but I guess I'll have to. 427-3772 is the number to call if you want.
All of the stars look down on your earth. Everyone can see everything that you do. And all of the heavens have watched you since birth. And you had your chance to watch them too. All of the trees, all of the flowers, and the birds fly high in your wings, make the heavens down to intervene before you reach the end. All of the rain that falls on your earth cannot cleanse away what's been done. Has required that we could. These are the unnatural facts. This is the last of the unnatural acts. First thing you do is drive right through that holy tunnel, pay your toll to the soul on the other side. Pick up your ticket for the heavenly highway. Ride, 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 baby, ride. You passed your last chance for sweet repentance. Get your halo off and wings cloud number 9. Check your gas and oil quick before you spoil. And ride, 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 baby, ride. Last thing you'll do is hear a jingle in your pocket when they start to do you further down the line. And all that funny money won't bring you milk and honey. So ride, 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 Abraham, ride. Rip on it all the way. Yes, a lollipop, you'll suck. Moon is also good for trucking. A little good luck and you'll get stuck in L.A. Drive on.
Two more by John Phillips from Jack of Diamonds. They were called Last of the Unnatural Acts and First and Last Thing You Do. Coming up, actually, when we play the next song, is an, I think I've never heard this one from the Mamas and the Papas. In fact, I've got the collected works. I've never seen it on their collected works. So that could be a real treat. If you stay tuned, you'll probably hear it. And you're tuned to Free Radio, 101.1 FM, www.freakradio.org. This is Robert Norris here in the studio. And you can join me at 427-3772 if you'd like to call in. Been talking about the Tax and Regulate Initiative, about the attack on the Wednesday drum circle at the sort of near now the farmer's market coming up next Wednesday. Come and help and support them. You want to see public spaces remain open to the community. And then some other issues like the postponement of the Sinister Sidewalk Citations for Singing trial that was scheduled to go in Robert Blind Bear Facer's case on Tuesday, but has been pushed ahead to July 20th in the courtroom of Kim Baskett and combined with my case. And it looks like Ed Fry is going to be taking those cases. He may actually have time to prepare this time with adequate documentation, getting all the, or trying to squeeze the information out of the police department that's necessary, including the very important information, which is important not just for us, the two of us, but for any other person on the street who wants to know whether a person who doesn't like what you're singing or playing or, I don't know, orating, if they think it's too loud, they just file a citizen arrest, take you to court, and say, you are disturbing my sleep, even if it's in the middle of the day. And that's sufficient? No, there has to be obviously some kind of real standard. And the police department so far has been refusing to say what that standard is that they're using, or what even the standard they're using to determine whether they'll even take these citations. And I remind you that when you when you are given a citation, you've got to be show up in court or pay $445, or have that go to collection and pay $745, as we just heard from Craig Canada, or face even worse consequences. So it's a rather serious matter, and apparently there is a drive by the police department, perhaps under the initiative of residents' associations or Santa Cruz Neighbors or Downtown Association, who knows, probably all these groups are sympathetic, to give business people and residents the power to essentially to veto what goes on the public sidewalks, even if it's not illegal. Because the ordinance that they're using doesn't say you're not allowed to sing songs or to play instruments if people object. Even if their objection is not based on content, but because they don't like the sound of it. Maybe it's bad music, or maybe it's, been going on for too long for them to really enjoy it. It's a pretty high standard as far as that goes, and I keep repeating it because most people don't know it, and they think that it's just the police have the right to say, well, we've gotten a complaint, either move along or you'll get a ticket. That's not the appropriate thing for the police to do. And one of the reasons that we didn't pack up our protest and leave, first of all, is because we'd stopped playing anyway, but we wanted to find out what the standards were. According to the law, you cannot make noises or sounds which are unreasonably disturbing or physically annoying to people of ordinary sensitiveness, or which are so harsh or so prolonged or unnatural or unusual in their use, time, or place as to cause physical discomfort to any person, and which are not necessary in connection with an activity which is otherwise lawfully performed. So, as I've said many a time on this station, jackhammering is allowed. Very loud, screechy motorcycles, if they're, I guess, necessary to their operation. I can't imagine why that actually is, but I don't know that much about motorcycles. That can be, however annoying or physically discomforting it may be, it's still legal. Similarly, my argument goes, if you're singing a political song, and that's disturbing someone, even stopping them from sleeping in the middle of the day, and this law only applies from 8 in the morning to 10 at night, you still can't use it. And if the police are using it to move people along, their real objective is not to enforce the law. Their real objective is to move people along and to pander to people in the businesses who want to establish a certain kind of downtown area. And that is something we have to fight, because we need a diverse downtown, not one that is dictated by the commercial fears, prejudices, and desires of a particular class in our society. And, of course, that's a fight all over the country, probably a fight all over the world. And maybe in understanding that, we can gain some strength and feel that we're not alone as we fight this fight. So I'm going to turn now to something that I actually had originally thought I wouldn't do, which is to play an interview I had about 3 weeks ago with a woman named Cynthia Kennedy. Now, you heard Cynthia, actually, she came in the studio and she talked about the same thing that she's now going to, well, this was the subject of the interview that I had when I first met her at a HUF meeting. And HUF is Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, for new listeners. It's a group that meets every Wednesday at the Sub Rosa Cafe. That's where I ran into her and heard this rather shocking story, which is still shocking to me and is kind of interesting because I learned later that she was, in the course of this, essentially it was an assault by a police officer named Azua, this is what she claims, that it actually happened while she was listening to some drumming downtown, and that this is what Azua was trying to stop. And he was doing it through both stopping the drummers and clearing away people listening. Again, all of this completely illegal, but based upon the threat of his own badge, gun, the fear of tickets and courts, the unseen complainant and anonymous complainant, and so forth. So I think it is relevant. And frankly, I think it's so shocking a story that it needs to be retold. And also, for those who heard Cynthia talk about it on the air, this is slightly, this is a different, this is an earlier conversation I had with her, so there are going to be some other details revealed that she didn't talk about on the air. So let's hear the story of a woman who, at least from her perspective, is trying to assert her rights and being brutalized for it by one of Santa Cruz's finest. I wasn't there. Perhaps it's all a lie. You be the judge.
Cynthia Kennedy.
And Cynthia, here we are at the Sub Rosa on a hippie Wednesday, as I just heard it called. Folks are having sandwiches, whooping it up and chowing down. And you're just out of jail.
Mm-hmm.
Today is April 13th. No, the 14th, 2010. What exactly were you in jail for, you criminal?
Apparently my charge is obstructing an officer, but every time I'd ask them, they would never tell me what my charge was. I got ignored. I asked the officer in his face when he was asking me for my ID, and he wouldn't tell me what I was being charged with.
Describe what happened right before the officer contacted you.
I was sitting down, eating a burrito, watching people play the drums. And,
a meat burrito?
No. Somebody had just come around and given everybody breakfast burritos, so I was just sitting down eating.
Where was this?
I think it was right by Borders.
Sidewalk?
On Pacific, yeah.
About what time of day and what day?
I would say probably like 9, somewhere around there.
Right.
I had seen the cop come up to break up the drum circle, and he came up to my friend and I and asked us to stand up, and I was like, okay, cool. Like, I'll stand up and back away from the building. Like, you know, I understand, like, that's the law. And so I stood up, and I put my back on. I've got my dog, and I'm still eating. And he goes back and talks to the people with the drums, and he comes back to me, and he's like, you need to move along. And I was like, I'm not doing anything that's against the law. Like, I'm watching people play music.
Right.
And he was like, you need to move along. And I was like, that's against the law. You can't just tell me to leave for no reason. And then as soon as I said that, he asked me for my ID, and I was like, I haven't broken the law. Like, I don't have to show you anything.
Uh-huh.
And he's like, no, I need to see some ID. And I was like, I don't have time for a consensual conversation. I walked away. And he followed me about like a half a block, and then he puts his arm on, like, grabs me and tries to stop me. And he was like, no, I need to see some ID. And I was like, again, I don't have time for this consensual conversation. I'm not breaking the law, and this is harassment. And
were other witnesses hearing this?
Yeah, there were several other people that watched it.
Names and addresses, of course, you immediately got.
Yep.
Really?
Actually, yes. No, everybody, we've got all the badge numbers and everything like that. Everybody is willing to do whatever they can. And I cut through to go onto Front Street, the one over on Pacific, and I came out by Trader Joe's, and like, next thing I know, like, there's the squad car with Officer Azua in it.
You remember the original officer's name who intervened?
Officer Azua.
It was the same officer.
Yep. And he left everybody else alone, and he followed me. And next thing I know, like, he grabs me, and he's like, you're under arrest. And I was like, what for? And again, he didn't tell me. And he puts me in handcuffs. My friend took my dog and my pack, and, like, there's, like, 5 squad cars that rolled up, and,
And the time of day, and...
About probably, like, 9, 10-ish, somewhere
in the afternoon, or in the morning?
In the evening.
And this was on Sunday, you say? No.
Saturday night.
So this is the 15th, that would be the 10th, perhaps.
Yeah. And...
Had you been drinking?
A little bit, but I wasn't, like, intoxicated, like, where my judgment was impaired.
You weren't accused of being under the influence.
No.
And you weren't held and released on a, you know, drunk and then released at 3 in the morning without charge?
No. When the officer, he, like, handcuffed me, and then he was like, well, we're going to search you before I put you in the back of my car. And I was like, I don't consent to a search.
Mm-hmm.
And he was like, well, that's fine. You don't have to consent to it. It's happening anyway. And I told him, I was like, I have not broken the law. You cannot tell me what I've done wrong. I was like, this is illegal.
Mm-hmm.
And a couple other people came up. I don't know the officer's names. I just focused on his name. And they start searching me. Like, they push me up against the car, and they went to go push me up against the car. I was already handcuffed, and
it's behind your back.
Yeah, and they tried pushing me, and I, like, stopped myself, because if I didn't stop myself, I was going to smack my face on the car. And they said I was resisting then, and they pulled the handcuffs even tighter. Like, I've got a huge bruise on my hand.
You're
from that.
To your right wrist.
My right wrist.
Which I can't see much of, but you probably can feel it.
Yeah, well, if you
it
look.
It looks like a slight, slight swollen area, actually.
And then the officers, like, are searching my pockets. They're not finding anything or anything like that. Like, again, I continued to ask them what I was being charged with and continued to say into the camera that I didn't consent to the search.
Were there any video people around who were actually videoing this?
Possibly. I know a bunch of people were watching it and taking notes and getting badge numbers and everything. They went to go search my side pouch, and since it's like on my belt, the way it was explained to me by another officer in San Francisco is it's considered a saddlebag, which is treated like a backpack, which can't be searched without a search warrant.
Well,
and
if you're being arrested incident to arrest, they usually claim they can search everything.
But they can't.
Mr. Lawyer.
I informed the officer that what they were doing was illegal, and I tried to move away. Like, I just moved my hip. Like, I was handcuffed, so I just moved my hip.
Obstructing an officer again, eh?
Apparently.
By the way, what is your name?
Cynthia.
Thank you, Cynthia.
And
you're being very cooperative. We appreciate that.
Oh, yeah. I don't want this to happen.
You're under arrest. Just kidding.
And the officer was like, whoa, whoa, whoa. And, like, all of them, all, like, five of them, like, start putting their hands on me. And I look at this one officer who goes to try to take me to the ground, and I'm looking at him like you're looking at me, just dead on. And he reaches behind my head and grabs my hair to bring me down to the ground. And, like, if I had let him pull me to the ground, I would have smacked my face on their ram bar. And I tried to stop myself from doing that, and, like, I moved my leg, and the officer was like, she's trying to kick me. And so, like, I end up getting, like, a kick to my leg and, like, one to my back, and I get a dreadlock ripped out, like, I mean, completely unnecessary. I wasn't resisting. I was informing them what they were doing was illegal, and I was trying to move out of the way. Like,
any reaction from the crowd while this was happening that you remember? Was there a crowd?
Yeah, there were a bunch of people watching, and all of them were like, no, she's trying to be peaceful. What you are doing is against the law. And, they still didn't tell me what I had been arrested for. We got to the jail, and they're going through my stuff, and they're taking pictures, and I asked them, I was like, so what am I being charged with? And they were like, well, we need to know your name. And I was like, well, I'm not telling you anything. I was like, I want to know what I'm being charged with before.
You can give them a thumbprint. If you don't have identification, you can always, that's part of the California code.
They ended up booking me because they were trying to figure out who I was because they didn't have any ID, because he told me to leave my pack. And my pack had my ID, like any tickets that I'd gotten, anything like that, was in my pack. And so they fingerprinted me and they took my picture and they were like, well, you're not coming up anywhere in the system. So they kept me in holding for a little bit longer, and then they put me from holding into my own cell where I sat for 3 days. I kept asking them when my pretrial was, when I was possibly being released, what I was charged with. Nobody answered me. Nobody told me anything.
Were you in the same cell or were you put in the general population?
I wasn't allowed to leave my cell.
Were you in, I don't know, pink or purple or whatever pajamas?
I was in orange or
orange,
something.
That doesn't sound like a very good color.
And, like, I continually asked them, like, what I had done wrong, like, what was my charge. Nobody would tell me. Everybody said they would find out, and they'd come back, and they never came back. They'd always forget.
Did you get any medical treatment?
No.
Did you ask for any?
I did. I asked somebody to look at my wrist and asked if I could get some ice, and I didn't get any. I asked for ibuprofen. I didn't get any of that.
You were allowed access to a telephone to make phone calls?
When I was in the holding cell, I asked to make a couple of phone calls, and I even asked to take a shower, and they wouldn't let me.
How long did that go on for?
For the 3 days that I was there. I was there.
Denied access to an attorney for 3 days.
Mm-hmm. I asked for a shower. I asked for a lawyer. They didn't give me anything. They just ignored me and pretended like I wasn't there.
Did you notice the names of any of the jailers who denied your request?
No, because when they
you were in the jail, right? Not the police station.
I was in the jail. Whenever they would come to my door, like it was generally to bring me food or to tell me something like. I don't know, one guy came to my door and, like, needed to check my TB test. And, like, as soon as they got what they wanted from me, they just slammed the door in my face. The other people that I talked to was over the intercom in my room. And then I was told Monday afternoon before lunch that I was going to be released after dinner. And so...
You were taken into custody on Saturday night.
Yep. And so, like, it's, like, 8 o'clock at night, you know, dinner's already been passed out, like, people are starting to go to sleep and everything, and I pushed the intercom button in my room, and I was like, somebody told me I'm supposed to be getting released today, and, the sergeant was like, oh, well, that's absolutely fucking ridiculous, you've only been here for, since Saturday night. They were like, you need to be here at least 72 hours, and you don't have bail, and you don't have this and that, and I was like, well, somebody told me I was supposed to be getting released, and she was like, well, they were wrong. And, like, that was the end of our conversation.
She didn't give her name or...
Nope.
This was a female sergeant?
Yeah. And then, or even when I was in the jail, when I was getting booked, to get searched before I got booked or anything like that. The female officer that was searching me while I was...
Deputy or police officer?
Sergeant. Or a sheriff. All the people that work at the jail are sheriffs.
Right.
And she, I'm in handcuffs still, and, I'm near the green padded wall where they search everybody before they go in. And she, again, went to go push me to go in, push me to go against the wall while I'm in handcuffs. And, I had nothing to stop myself, so I slightly resisted. I didn't, push back or anything like that. I just held my posture. And she grabs the handcuffs in the middle, and she's like, if you resist again, I'm going to put you on the fucking ground. And I'm like, I'm not doing anything. I'm not going to smack my face against the wall, though.
You told her that.
Yeah. And I was like, I will gladly do whatever you want me to do as long as you respect my rights.
Mm-hmm.
And she was like, at this point, you don't have any.
That's what she said.
Mm-hmm.
Well, she was right, of course.
That's her.
Yeah, I'm was treated like
however,
a criminal.
Here's your dinner.
Oh, sweet.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
A piece of chocolate.
But for the 3 days, I didn't eat or anything like that. I looked at them and I'm like, there's no point, you know. I mean.
But they offered you meals.
They offered me food.
Tasty, very kind of tastefully prepared in their kitchen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, five star.
Mm-hmm. How many meals were you offered? Just one every three? Three a day? Or?
Three a day. Sandwiches at lunch and then trays for breakfast and dinner.
And how many times did you request medical aid?
Every day.
And what were you told?
I was told that somebody would be with me, and they never were. I was treated like I had killed somebody, like I should be completely shamed for what I had done.
Right.
When I didn't do anything wrong other than eat my dinner on the sidewalk.
Right. Well, eating your dinner on the sidewalk without a permit in Santa Cruz, you know, can be considered something of an offense. So.
And I pointed out to Officer Azua as well that he wasn't telling anybody that was dressed nicely in a button-down shirt or a nice blouse and a skirt to move. He wasn't telling anybody else to move. He went straight for the kid with a pack and a dog and dreadlocks.
Well, he knows who his enemies are. We know who you are and how to deal with you.
Because mm-hmm. we're horrible people.
For sure. And those dreadlocks, I don't know what to do. We've got to give you a better style. So... do you want to give your full name for this? This is a radio tape. Now, do you want this account given? Because if they take you to trial, you can't normally be forced to testify against yourself. But if this is on the air, they will claim it's, you know, public testimony, and this can be provided. If you don't want this to go out, you should tell me. And I warn people about this, but I always think it's more important to give this stuff out to the community. But I'm more interested in their information than your rights. So you have to be careful. So you should tell me what you want me to do.
I would rather everybody know exactly, who I am, just in case they want any more details or who the officers were, anything like that. I'm completely fine with it.
You want to give out your full name?
Yeah, I already did. It's Cynthia Kennedy.
As in the famous Kennedy clan?
Yes.
Do you intend to call your rich relatives in?
possibly.
Indeed. That'll show them. So, if people want to reach you by email or by phone in order to give a description of what they saw if they happened to be there on Saturday, around 10 o'clock at night on
yep.
April 10th?
My email is Cynthia, Cynthia_Montana, is in the state, Montana, at Yahoo. And I don't have a phone.
Okay.
So that's the best way to get me. I check my email all the time.
Are you intending to eat any more meals downtown on the sidewalk?
Absolutely.
Shocking. Here's my little card here. If you want to come on the air and actually answer questions from the studio, I have a show tomorrow night.
Sweet.
Otherwise, I'll play this probably tomorrow night or Sunday morning, assuming I don't drop it on the ground. And, you know, we'll take it from there, which means actually nowhere, unless somebody takes some initiative, because
I plan on filing a lawsuit.
You first have to win your criminal case. When's your court appearance?
I didn't get a citation or anything like that. All I got was.
They ever tell you?
No, they've never actually verbally said what I was charged.
You're pulling
with.
Out a yellow slip here.
It says Santa Cruz County Field Arrest Report, and then it says my charge 148A, which is obstructing a police officer, but it doesn't say anything about court. anything like that. I was never given anything else.
Can I take a look?
Yeah. I don't have an address, so, like, they're not going to mail me anything.
The recording officer is D. Williams, 186. Is that a deputy or is that a...
I believe that was the... No, I think that was the sergeant. And then this was Baldwing.
Searching officer.
Number 77. That was the sheriff that was the one that threatened to put me on the ground.
The first is SCPD, the second is sheriff?
Yep. She works in the jail, and this was the sergeant that, when I asked him for a lawyer, he said that he wasn't going to call one for me. And then Officer Azua, badge number 147.
700 Front Street is the address of the arrest, and Azua's badge number is 147.
When I find out what my court and all that stuff is, I'm going to pursue a lawsuit.
To stay in town?
For a little bit, yeah. I'll definitely come back if I need to for anything like this.
And have you been able to make contact with any of the witnesses who saw this?
Yes.
Please inform me so the police can arrest them as well.
Are you looking for names of the people, or?
No, what I'm saying is I'm glad you have been able
yeah.
to. I'm not suggesting you necessarily want to put these out publicly unless they wish to be so identified. So you're welcome to come tomorrow night to Free Radio. If you do, you go to the 7-Eleven at Chestnut and Laurel at 5:45. And you wait for me. I will come surreptitiously blindfold and gag you and drag you off to the station. This is a secret location. Actually, what will happen is, you know, I'll take you there. You have to call me beforehand, however, to let me know that you're actually going to be there, because otherwise...
I'll for sure be there.
Okay.
Yep.
Call and say, I'm really coming. I'm really, really, really coming. And the number is 423-HUFF.
Okay.
It's on the card.
Okay.
And all that information is also on the card. We're having a Huff meeting in case you get bored. We're gonna.
Yeah, that's the reason I was here this morning.
Wow. And you wonder, where the hell are these Huffsters? And it's just me. And, of course, this man is the leader of Huff. I have nothing to do with it, actually. He claims innocence. But look at the cap. Look at.
And that was Cynthia Kennedy at a Huff meeting a couple weeks ago, who not only came to a Huff meeting here, but who also called before the show, came to the Thursday show, and then showed up on the Sunday show as well. And so she's talked about this case before, but if her account is true, it needs to be talked about again and again and again until something is done about Officer Azua and toleration of this kind of behavior by the police department. I don't know. Maybe it's not been tolerated. Maybe Officer Zua has been severely reprimanded. No idea. I haven't spoken to him about it. Haven't seen him. And I have not filed a formal complaint with the police department. I have just sent off an email to Cynthia Kennedy looking for an update on what's been happening in her case. So we'll see if anything happens with that. I did get an email from one of the participants in the Americans for Safe Action meeting, which was very small. It didn't have apparently enough to have that 10 members for a chapter. According to this participant, there were only three or four people, I guess Craig Canada was one of them, who were not originally part of Roger Mensch's group from the Hemporium. Roger Mensch, as Craig Canada mentioned, is a guy who had a medical marijuana distribution I want to call it a store, collective, cooperative, which has been harassed mercilessly up in Felton, where he lives, first by D.A. Bob Lee, that's the great liberal D.A. of Santa Cruz County, and then more recently by Santa Clara County for violating the drug laws around marijuana. And he goes to trial in May. I don't know the exact date. I think it's the 17th, actually. I think Craig is probably right about that. I think it's in San Jose. And still having trouble reaching him, so I don't know what's happening with that. But I guess this person who was at the meeting noted that they were not, was a little concerned that they hadn't been putting up any flyers or done any outreach at the dispensaries, Greenway and Limekiln, in order to get more people involved. That would seem to be a good place to do it. Maybe on the sidewalk so you don't get the goon squads from the dispensaries trying to come after you. And although, who knows? They might try to come after you on the public sidewalk. It happened to us. They sent out the police on citizen arrests for singing, I guess, and we were leafleting and petitioning as well in January. So it is, you know, you have to be prepared to address those kinds of unconstitutional behaviors by both private businesses and private individuals who somehow think they have the police on their side and who may in fact have the police on their side. So I would like to see an Americans for Safe Access chapter set up, and I guess if people are interested, they can try to get in touch with Roger Mensch, who I believe does have an email address. I'm going to the indiebay.org website to see if he's there. I think he did post a story there recently. Let's see if there's one there. We'll take a peek. Americans for Safe Access. It's an announcement of the meeting. He mentions the meeting last week, but there's no mention of an email address where he can be reached or a phone number. I think he gave it out on the air when he called in a couple months before, but he hasn't called me back. I'm really reluctant to, you know, give out that kind of information if I'm not getting a response. I really wish him well with that ASA chapter. There is a website for Americans for Safe Access, www.americansforsafeaccess.org, in case people are interested in that. So you certainly can go there and check that out. That's a possibility. I've gotten some interesting emails, and forwarded some interesting emails for those of you who are interested in homeless civil rights issues. I've been doing some stuff. I've sent out some stuff recently. There's a little story from Alaska, which I haven't gotten too much more information on other than what was forwarded to me, a couple of paragraphs. Anchorage, Alaska, the American Civil Liberties Union of Alaska has filed a lawsuit challenging raids conducted on homeless camps by the municipality of Anchorage. ACLU Executive Director Jeffrey Mittman says the lawsuit was filed Wednesday on behalf of Dale Engel and other homeless people who have had property destroyed in the raids. The lawsuit asks the city be stopped from carrying out its policy of giving homeless people as little as 12 hours' notice to clean out their belongings. It also asks the court to declare the seizure and destruction of the homeless residents' personal belongings without affording any due process or obtaining a warrant as unconstitutional. Municipal Attorney Dennis Wheeler did not immediately return a phone call seeking comment. And of course, this is kind of interesting because, as I've said many a time on this show, we have a similar illegal procedure used by Chief Ranger John Wallace in the Poganip, who goes up there and tags camps if he doesn't directly slash and destroy them, as some claim he has, and then within 3 days sends in labor-ready crews to haul away personal property without storing it as required by California law, and without giving due notice of it, without holding it as evidence of a crime, which it is, because they're sleeping or camping up there. And that's criminal behavior, as we all know. I'm looking at the Anchorage, Alaska ACLU to see if I can find any more details on this lawsuit. And let's see what I found here. Alaska ACLU sues over homeless camp raids. The ACLU lawsuit was filed on behalf of disabled veteran Dale Engel. So he wasn't just homeless, he was a disabled veteran. Both disabled and a veteran. And there are plenty of people like that around here who are homeless, or a number of them anyway, who says, and who haven't got a vet's hall yet, and not a pot to piss in, it looks like, thanks to the county. That's another story. Who says the homeless camp where he lives was raided and his belongings seized or destroyed, including irreplaceable souvenirs of better times in the life of a homeless person, a letter from a now-dead child or parent, military medals, a photo album from a wedding. He says medals he got from serving in the Army and the National Guard were taken in 2006, and that his tent and sleeping bag were taken last spring. Taking the sleeping bags and tents from homeless campers deprives the poorest among us of the few possessions they have. The complaint says Engel says he tried to get the medals and ribbons back, but was told by authorities they were gone. And now, if you tried that with somebody, you'd be guilty of theft and face a couple years in jail. But Chief Ranger Wallace rages on. The lawsuit challenges a change in laws that cut in half the required time to give notice to residents of tent cities to clear out, giving the homeless only 12 hours to leave a homeless camp before their belongings are seized and destroyed. At least three camps have been raided since the ordinance was passed last July, the lawsuit states. For a homeless person, this inadequate period of notice provides no relief for someone who may not be present during the 12 hours when notice is posted, the lawsuit states. It is entirely impossible for a notice to be posted in the morning while a homeless camper is away searching for employment, looking for food, or attempting to find better shelter during inclement weather. Plaintiffs seek an order that notification laws and the raids are unconstitutional. The lawsuit was filed by Thomas Stenson with the ACLU of Alaska. Wouldn't it be nice if the ACLU of Santa Cruz could get off its collective well-funded asses and do something as well? And I'm afraid that is not too likely. My response to this story, actually the shorter version, was this, as I wrote out on the Huff email list. And you, by the way, you can get these kinds of emails if you're interested by just sending an email to Robert Norse, or I should say rnorse3@hotmail.com. That's me. rnorse3@hotmail.com. And you can get on the Huff email list, or you can get just the emails of protests and demonstrations, which are fewer and won't swamp you with a lot of email if that's not what you want. What I wrote was, if the Anchorage ACLU can do it, what's wrong with Santa Cruz? Could it be that we're top-heavy with politicians pandering to bigotry like Mayor Mike Rotkin and Vice Mayor Ryan Coonerty, both ACLU members, Rotkin's on the board? Chief Ranger John Wallace regularly harasses homeless people whose only possessions they carry with them or have to leave in illegal camps there, since there is no legal place to sleep anywhere in Santa Cruz for 1,500 to 2,000 homeless people. Most recently, Wallace threatened Robert Blind Bear Facer, a 62-year-old Amish homeless man who is appealing his sleeping van tickets, telling him he must move his survival gear or have it hauled away and presumably destroyed. This actually happened on April 27th, 2 days ago, the same day that Robert Facer went to court for playing a drum softly while the rest of us were singing the song Downtown, which is a sort of a homeless version of the Petula Clark song way back in January, and that singing on the sidewalk sinister citation stuff. So that's the local nasty scene. And what's happening in Anchorage, which, again, is moving past Santa Cruz on the civilization quotient. There's probably more on this story. Let me see if I have anything more I want to pass on. Let me check it out here. Now, I think it's time for that mystery Mamas and Papas number by John Phillips. So here it comes. We'll be right back. And that's Fantastic Four by the Mamas and the Papas. That one was never released, I guess, at least not until now. Yeah, perhaps I can understand why it wasn't released, but I like the Mamas and the Papas, so I'll be playing one that was released off of the their last album, People Like Us, when I play another song, which shouldn't be too long down the road. A couple of quick notes here. Longtime listeners of the show may remember Robert Whittaker, author of the book Madness in America, who has been on my show a couple of times by phone in an interview. He's authored four books, actually Mad in America. He's also written a couple of fiction books, The Mapmaker's Wife and On the Laps of the Gods. Actually, The Mapmaker's Wife is a fiction. On the Laps of the Gods is not. It's a I think it's a story about race riots in the 20s, I believe, and it's an interesting historical study. He was a writer for the Boston Globe in the 90s, and my connection with him and my interest in his writing came from his work on so-called mental illness and how he has documented real concerns that people on psychiatric medication generally do worse than those who aren't on psychiatric medication in the long term. And he's not a psychiatrist, he's just sort of a researcher who didn't have, he claimed, any preconceptions about it. And he's very articulate about it. His book is very interesting, gives a very interesting history. The book Mad in America, his first book, which came out in 2003, I think it was, maybe 2004. And he talks about the kinds of vicious isn't quite the word, I guess, because they didn't think they were vicious, medieval, cruel kinds of treatments that psychiatrists at the dawn of the Republic, the American Republic, used and have been using ever since in different stages of development. It's quite a history, he writes, Mad in America. He has another book out now, which he talked about, because it kind of sprang from a long article. The book, I wonder if I have the, I'll have to go to the, I think it's called Anatomy of an Epidemic, and it's about, there's a huge increase in diagnosed mental illness in the United States. And it's Whittaker's claim, I think, well, it's the claim of a number of authors. It may still be Whittaker's claim that this is a function of the pharmaceutical industry. And it's as well as the psychiatric industry. And I'm going to try to have him on the air talking about his new book some point in the near future. And maybe that'll happen. He's been very forthcoming about that kind of stuff. A couple other things. Santa Cruz has its sitting ban. San Francisco has a proposed sit-lie ordinance, which I've talked about a little bit. More important, it has a resistance to the sit-lie ordinance, which has gotten together and done at least 2 days of citywide resistance where people are coming out and sitting on the sidewalk, which isn't hard to do these days because right now it isn't legal. I mean, it isn't illegal, but it will be illegal if Mayor Gavin Newsom's ordinance passes the Board of Supervisors, or if he puts it on the ballot and he gets it passed by the voters using the usual the homeless scare tactics that have been successful in passing a few other measures. The story, however, which is interesting, is titled Day Laborers Protest Proposed San Francisco Sit-Lie Ordinance. And this is by Sudan Thanawala of the AP. San Francisco, day laborers and domestic workers protested Saturday, that's last Saturday, against an ordinance introduced by Mayor Gavin Newsom last month that would make it illegal to sit or lie on public sidewalks. At the demonstration in the city's Mission District, about 40 people sat in metal chairs and stood along the sidewalk, some holding signs that read, "Sidewalks are for people, no on sit-lie." Teresa Delgado, 40, an immigrant from Mexico who spoke through an interpreter, said her husband, Erasmo, often walks hours on the streets to be picked up for work and needs to be able to sit down. Her message for the mayor, don't push for this law because it would affect me and other working class families. Tony Winokur, a spokesman for the mayor, said the law is not intended to go after people like Delgado's husband who are looking for work on the streets. The goal is instead to give the police officer another tool to target threatening behavior on city sidewalks that affects residents and business owners, particularly in the city's Haight-Ashbury neighborhood, Winokur said. Unfortunately, opponents continue to make exaggerated and hyperbolic claims about our proposal, he said. Now, Nick, pause briefly to say, this tool rhetoric that's used to rubber stamp any police proposal that comes slouching down the road. It was this, we have our own parking lot panic law, the downtown ordinances that make it illegal to sit on a bench now for more than an hour, the law that makes it illegal to sit within 14 feet of a sculpture, and hence now within 14 feet of these panhandling meters that they're going to put in. All these are the useful tools of the police department if they need them, you know, to move along the wrong kind of person. I don't think it should be really advanced math for people to understand that this puts a lot of power in the hands of men and women with badges, guns, and an insulated, closed sort of militaristic ethic, which may make you feel safer if you live in the fantasy world that police people are your friends. But, you know, actually, the circles of friends we have, you know, are hard won. And most people in the world, although we're all common members of the community, you know, we have to kind of negotiate with each other. We'll have differences of opinion. When you give one group of people a special amount of power, or they're serving another group of people who have power and are getting them to exercise it, merchants, then you are in a position where you better watch out. So the tools thing is it always makes me kind of grimace whenever I run across that. You know, more tools for the police. Threatening behavior. You know, threatening behavior is illegal. Sitting down is not threatening behavior. And this is, of course, it's only threatening to merchants who believe that they have the right to clear people away from their stores because it's a threat to their profits, they think. And in Santa Cruz, of course, there's a lot of dispute about this. I mean, some people feel that the presence of different groups of people is actually a draw, not, you know, a form of dissuasion for folks. Continuing with the San Francisco sit-live protest, Newsom, that's the mayor, unveiled two versions of the sit-live ordinance at a Board of Supervisors meeting last month. One would apply to the entire city, while the other, that's the one Santa Cruz originally got before a protest and the courts turned that one down, while the other would only affect certain commercial areas. That's kind of like the one we have now, which is only in business districts. Winokur said the mayor would pursue a ballot measure if the Board of Supervisors did not pass a sit-lie law in San Francisco. Saturday's protest by day laborers was among several demonstrations in the city, including a performance by drag queens on the sidewalk in the Tenderloin District against the proposed ordinance. Andy Blue, one of the organizers of the event, said the law is not necessary. If people are being threatened or violent, there are laws against those things, he said. There shouldn't be a law against sitting on the sidewalk. And again, in Santa Cruz, that's one of the few laws that mass protests defeated after they were passed by the city council, the Rotkin-Kennedy City Council, I should say the Rotkin-Matthews-Kennedy City Council, in 1994. And then, of course, Kennedy went back and passed a more limited law that has creeped up and expanded again so that 95% of the Pacific Avenue sidewalks and 100% of all sidewalks in other business districts are illegal to sit on, illegal to have political tables on, illegal to street perform for donation on, and illegal to peacefully spare change on. Santa Cruz, City of Liberty. So, regarding that old conflict, you may remember that, not really very important, just, I don't know, what, $14 billion a month in Iraq and Afghanistan, systematic routine and sanctioned murder of civilians, huge military bases. You know, those that conflict that Obama, you know, the great Obama, was going to take us out of. I remember having a chat with Mark Half Moon about this, and he was telling me how it was really important that we understand Obama's doing the best he can. And I reminded him that McGovern, when he ran in 1972, promised to have troops out of Vietnam within 90 days. Obama could do the same in both these countries. He's choosing not to. And worse, we're choosing those. I'm not choosing, really, but although I'm not out there screaming as much as I might be, or camping in front of the federal building, or doing whatever is necessary to bring this issue into a high profile, a lot of people are just giving this whole policy a pass while they were screaming at the top of their voices when Bush was in power. There's murder going on in your name out there, folks. It's just true. One person wrote, "What do you mean we have no exit strategy? Have you not been paying attention the past 50 years? Destroy the country, wreak utter havoc, murder the citizenry, befoul the environment, blow a couple trillion bucks, increase global resentment to the United States by 2,400%, foster terrorism, get defeated and come home, declare victory, throw a parade. What part don't you get?" I like that one. That was a response to the Guardian article, which talked about it discussed. I wonder if I have the Guardian article here. I don't. I do, however, have a little bit from Dennis Perrone on the proposed tax and regulate initiative, which I'm going to read about. He says, regarding the limits of 1 ounce and 25 square feet for personal cultivation, imagine a law to tax and regulate alcohol that only allows for possession of up to one bottle of wine, imprisoning those who exceed that amount, be it two bottles or a small collection of choice vintages. These limits guarantee confusion, harassment, and black marketeering forevermore. We don't control alcohol by imposing a 25-square-foot limit on grapevines, but one extra gram or square foot of pot means jail, and even worse. This initiative specifies that if accused of having too much cannabis, the burden of proof is on you, not the state. Regarding taxes, singling out those who want to use marijuana for a huge excise tax is just plain unfair. It maintains cannabis as the most expensive, blatantly overpriced product on the market, thus forcing most people to choose cheaper, more dangerous drugs with huge externalized costs to society as a whole. Regarding minors, sending teenagers to state prison. Hang on a second here. I've lost my way. I'll find it again. Sending teenagers to state prison for 3 years for pot is evil. This initiative mandates that 18, 19, and 20-year-old minors serve 3 to 7 year terms in California state prison for the crime of passing each other a joint or selling one another a small amount. Under this law, if a 21-year-old person passes a joint to a 20-year-old, he or she goes to county jail for 6 months. Likewise, this measure has no exceptions for parents in their own homes from the smoking cannabis in any space where minors are present prohibition. We don't lock up parents for having a glass of wine with dinner, and we certainly don't tell the kids to leave the house for the purpose of consuming any other substance. So why start with cannabis? And those are a couple of the comments by Dennis Perrone on the issue of the tax and regulate proposition. Yes, he says a few more things, too. Perrone vows that if proponents buy enough signatures, and they have, to get the initiative on the ballot, he will campaign against it. Quote, "This initiative is bad for parents, students, and ultimately the effort to get the state to stop ruining lives enforcing these draconian pot laws. Initiatives create permanent statutes. This one, with its petty restrictions for personal users, prohibitive unfair taxes, and mandatory state prison sentences for teenagers, needs to be nipped in the bud." It wasn't, apparently, because it got on the ballot. "We will campaign and vote against it should its proponents succeed in purchasing the necessary number of signatures to put it on the 2010 ballot. The tax revenue it will supposedly generate is a mere smokescreen for the kids it will regulate into 3, 5, and 7 year state prison sentences. perpetrating and increasing the $100 million-plus tax dollars per year the state already spends policing this harmless plant is wrong, yet that is exactly what this proposition does. Richard Lee is that's the fellow who introduced the proposition and paid for it and who owns the Oaksterdam dispensary. There used to be 14 up there. Oakland did a Santa Cruz number and squelched the, three-fourths of the dispensaries, leaving only four open. Richard Lee is a 47-year-old marijuana activist who runs various medical marijuana programs and cannabis-related educational projects throughout the Oaksterdam area of downtown Oakland, California. He operates a coffee shop and a marijuana dispensary. He has been active in working to end cannabis prohibition since 1992. He is the chief promoter of a petition drive to legalize marijuana in California, which began on December 14, 2009. And actually, it was announced on that date that there were enough signatures to qualify, and I believe it was announced last week or the week before that the signatures have actually been counted. A fellow activist gave the following account of Richard Lee, which I have no way of verifying. The source of Richard Lee's dough is a matter of inheritance, an old TX Wildcat or granddaddy's oil money, or so I'm told to begin with, and a serious business savvy to turn that into a lot more. He ran a hemp store in Houston before moving to California and making a mint on the original Oaksterdam, the 17 dispensaries clubs near the current school, before they got shut down by cops and community, reducing the name to his school, a trademark, whereas it used to refer to a four-block area of Oakland. He owns Blue Sky, a fairly busy dispensary, one of only four allowed in Oakland now, plus the school, the Bulldog Coffee Shop, and a fair amount of real estate downtown. Once again, so I'm told by solid sources. $20 million is a lot and probably comes from some men behind the curtain more than Tricky Dick Lee himself. And I guess I'm not sure if that is the amount of money they intend to spend on this initiative or not. Let's see what else we got here. I'm really having trouble with this computer. Keeps skipping on me, but I'm not giving up. If you have any thoughts on any of this stuff, you can call in, 427-3772. Regarding these downtown ordinances that we have that make it illegal for homeless people to give them very little public space and turn most of the public sidewalks into commercial thoroughfares. Here's a story. Criminal adultery: states ponder the continuation of puritanical laws. This was a column. And where did I get it from? Oh, boy. Well, it was interesting enough for me to pull aside, so I'm going to read a bit of it. Today's column is on the continued criminalization of adultery in states across the country. It is a critical battle over morality legislation in the United States. Across the country, some social conservatives are fighting for what they view as a critical article of faith, criminal adultery laws. In the U.S., in the year 2010, people can still be prosecuted for breaching their marital vows. The laws are some of the last remnants of our puritanical past, where infidelity was treated as not only a marital but also as a criminal matter. While the laws have been challenged as unconstitutional, many people are resistant to the idea of removing such morality crimes from our books. In New Hampshire, for instance, legislators are trying to repeal a 200-year-old adultery law that is widely viewed as unconstitutional. Social conservatives, however, insist that such laws are needed to back up moral dictates with criminal sanctions. And a lot of this is the mentality behind the marijuana stuff, the drug war. A 1997 poll showed that 35% of Americans believe adultery should be a crime, and similar efforts to decriminalize adultery have met with opposition in states such as Illinois and Minnesota. For many civil libertarians, it is an equally important moment when our nation can finally move beyond laws that require citizens to comply with the moral dictates of their neighbors. About two dozen states still have laws criminal adultery provisions. While prosecutions remain rare, they do occur, and beyond the criminal realm, these provisions can be cited in divorce proceedings, custody disputes, employment cases, and even to bar people from serving on juries. Though someone such as Tiger Woods might not be prosecuted, these laws could be cited in any divorce proceedings to show not just infidelity, but also possible criminality in his lifestyle. And there's more on this article. If you Google for criminal adultery, states ponder the continuation of puritanical laws, you'll be able to come up with this. And I also had some stories that I'm not going to have time to read about turmoil in Iraq, how the governing party, al-Maliki, is attempting to maintain power by having the other party, which won a majority, or at least won more seats than they did, declared, first of all, insisting on a recount, second of all, ruling that they can't run certain candidates, and it's looking like a mess, because it's likely to lead to more sectarian war, and of course there's recently there have been huge bombings happening in Iraq, and the United States has more than 90,000 troops there, and no clear intention that those troops, I'm talking about all the troops, are going to be withdrawn, and if they are withdrawn, if they're not going to show up in Afghanistan next door, or just one country over. Another story I was going to read is PTSD, cops and vets, a killer cocktail, PTSD, and your local police. The moment that Austin police officer Wayne Williamson began unloading his pistol in a filled parking lot was probably the first sign he realized he hadn't left Iraq too far behind. Williamson never hit his target, a fleeing, possibly armed suspect, but only one of the bullets he discharged in the parking lot was ever found. It was lodged in the back seat of a car in which two children, a 14-year-old girl and a 4-month-old baby, had been sitting. Miraculously, neither was injured. There were no excuses or cover-ups, however. Williamson has subsequently been terminated from his 9-year career as a police officer. He's one of thousands of veterans who have returned from Iraq and Afghanistan with post-traumatic stress disorder, though he had not been treated for it before the aforementioned incident on March 14, 2007. National Guardsman who left his job at the Austin Police Department to go to war in 2005, Williamson saw heavy combat in Tikrit before coming home and going back on patrol. He later told a reporter how a fleeing suspect like the one he'd encountered in the parking lot would have to be handled in Iraq. Bad guys get away over there, they come back with things strapped to their chest, and they don't mind blowing themselves up, and you or somebody else around them, he told writer Jordan Smith, who added, that was a soldier's lesson. It seemed that no one at the APD, Austin Police Department, thought to help him unlearn before he returned to patrol. Let's hope that Officer Perry isn't doing the same thing. He, I think, spent some time overseas. I haven't noticed that he is, so I'm not accusing him of that. But this is a matter of real concern. Shows how vets are treated. And I'm not sure what the percentage of, there may be a higher percentage of police officers who do this than other professions. That I don't know if that's true or not. Beginning of the end for the Afghan war was another article I have. There's some hope by one author that, he writes, imagine the United States were expending an amount that exceeded 60% of its national income on the military and police. For comparison, the U.S. Department of Defense budget, bloated as it is about 5% of the GDP, gross domestic product. Of course, it's about 50 or 60% of the budget, but that's another story. And spending on police is less than 1% of the GDP. That's the gross domestic product. Of course, the United States would never reach these levels of spending, but it's worth thinking about because any population in this situation will be looking for a way out. It is true for the people of Afghanistan, where spending for army and police is programmed for $11.6 billion, 61% of the projected GDP, gross domestic. That's all the goods and services created in the country. I'm going to leave it there and hope to get back to you again on Sunday with actually some more of my standard stuff, some interviews, maybe some discussions with folks around the current situation of the Drum Circle downtown, and who knows what else. So check in with me then, or give me a call between times at 423-HUFF, 423-4833. If you want more details on court cases like the Sinister Sidewalk Street Singers, go to Santa Cruz Indie Media, indiebay.org/Santa Cruz, or just Google for Sinister Street Singers, put it all in quotes, and you'll come up with the right story, or at least one of the stories. Thanks for being with me in this edition of Bathrop Spears Broadsides. I think we can probably do it again at some point. The sooner the better.
No dough, no place to go. I pick hope on the late night show. Then you give your love to me, then I'll give it back to you. Pass the chips, you've got salt on your lips.
Not the news, it gives you the
same to you.